My special guests today are Dr. Ben Beck, who's a research fellow here at Monash Uni, and Professor Peter Cameron, who is Divisional Director of the School of Public Health and Academic Director of Emergency and Trauma at Alfred Hospital. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Now, you two have co-authored, along with a few other people, some research on traumatic brain injuries here in Victoria. From my reading of it, there's some good news in there. Tell me about what you did and what you found.
Yeah, so we looked at the incidence of severe traumatic brain injury over a 9-year study period. So we're looking at that from 2006 to 2014, using the population-based Victorian State Trauma Registry. So we were looking at severe TBI that was defined as a Glasgow Coma Scale score of 3 to 8, as well as a AIS, so an abbreviated injury scale score of 3 or more. And so the main finding, and as you suggested, the good news story out of this is that we're seeing a decline in severe TBI over the 9-year study period. And so it's declining at a rate of about 5% per year. I think probably the best news is the road trauma group. So they kind of, the transport-related group make up the majority of these events. And so in the road trauma group, and specifically motor vehicles, which declined at 11% a year, as well as the cyclists, which declined at 12% per year, we're seeing some really, really nice numbers, and it's good to see those rates declining. We also saw declines in the pedestrian group and the motorcycle group, although the decline was non-significant in that motorcycle group.
Okay. So we hear a lot in the media, you know, there's a lot of sensational media attention paid to king hits, intentional violence. What does your study tell us about the number of injuries that happened because of that and what's happened to that over the last 9 years or so?
Yeah, so we are seeing a reduction in those intentional events. So that includes the interpersonal violence as well as self-harm events. Mm-hmm. They do make up a very small proportion of the total number of severe TBI.
What sort of small proportion are we talking about?
So the incidence of that group was around 0.6 cases per 100,000 population.
And 600% of the media
attention. Yeah, exactly.
That is a big issue, though. I mean, if you actually look at the burden for, you know, society, and you look at what's in the paper versus what's on the statistics, there's no sort of correlation at all. And that's where our biggest opportunities are, is in reducing, even though we've had this massive reduction with vehicles, there's still the biggest opportunity there for reduction. And you know, I think the TAC Towards Zero campaign is on the money, because we've shown that these interventions work. And if you can reduce by 20%, 30% the number of severe head injuries, that's huge in terms of the impact on society.
And the financial impact as well.
Well, financial, but in some ways the money doesn't matter. You actually look at the impact of a family of, you know, let's say a 20-year-old with severe brain injury for the next, you know, 30, 40 years, the impact on the family is huge. Each one of those is sort of like a whole 30 or 40 people affected, a lifetime story.
So let's talk about the little bit of bad news in the results. Falls. Tell us what you found there.
So the falls group, so specifically the low falls, increased over the study period. And so that's obviously a concern, that this predominated in the 65 plus age group. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about elderly low falls here that are increasing at a rate that we need to be concerned about, and it's something that we need to start looking at, increasing efforts to prevent these incidents.
Were you able to discern different kinds of falls, you know, falls from medical conditions or falling over things? Is it able to differentiate those?
No, so what we did was we just looked at those low fall groups, which were basically defined as a fall from less than a metre or from standing height.
Right.
And so we weren't able to look at some of the factors that were involved in those falls, but certainly those issues, and Peter's probably best speaking to this, but those issues are of concern about what's actually causing these falls.
So there's a little bit of artifact in the older person falling data. If you go back 20, 30 years, an old person fell out of bed in the nursing home, they wouldn't have come to hospital.
No.
And yet sometimes they have quite severe injuries, but the family, you know, decides they don't want to go any further with it, and that's, you know, that's the way they're managed. The expectation now in society around that group is different, for better or for worse, and a lot of those patients come to the emergency department, they get scans, they show they have major head injuries, or, you know, and a whole lot of consequences follow. So it's a complicated area, and much more difficult to target than something like, you know, if we didn't have any car accidents, there would be no trauma. We could, road trauma.
Yep.
With the older persons, though, it's also about the social, the medical conditions associated with them, and so it's not as straightforward in terms of the way we target prevention and reduce that burden.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of stuff, and the other thing to remember is we're using a lot more anticoagulants, so blood thinners, and antiplatelet agents. And again, if you've got them on board and you just happen to knock your head against something, all of a sudden you become a major trauma.
Are we talking about the novel anticoagulants?
Well, the whole spectrum. Yeah. Like, if you go out there now and you go to an old person's home, you'll find half the people on some sort of anticoagulant.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, it just puts them all at risk. So it's a very complicated area, and I think it needs, it's more than just a sort of injury. You know, it's not a matter of wrapping them in cotton wool or something.
Yeah.
It's a whole structured program, including, you know, some of the programs we've been running here, like things like balance training, improvements in medications so that they don't get hypotension when they stand up, all these sorts of things which, you know, you don't traditionally think of as injury prevention.
So what's the next step? What needs to be done next, do you think?
I think obviously we're seeing some really good progression and reductions in that road trauma group, but we're still seeing an incidence that's reasonably high, and so we still need to work towards trying to reduce the incidence of severe TBI across all the groups that we've looked at.
Yep.
So we've looked at, obviously, some of these reductions can be explained by both active and passive safety measures in vehicles, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Also, mass media campaigns, increased law enforcement. All of these issues are working in a positive direction, but we need continued efforts to try and continue to reduce the incidence in the road trauma group. And I think specifically the vulnerable road users. So.
Mm-hmm.
The pedestrians, cyclists and the motorcyclists, we need to continue to try and identify strategies that are going to work. So, for example, this might mean with cyclists increasing or improving infrastructure. So having separated bicycle lanes, trying to reduce that risk of a cyclist interacting with a motor vehicle. Lower speed zones, things like that are going to work within that road trauma space.
Yeah.
And I think within the interpersonal violence group, we still need to continue to work towards reducing risk associated with these events. And alcohol has been shown to be one of those risks. And so we need to work towards continuing trying to reduce intoxication levels.
Sure. I mean, the lockout laws in Sydney seem to be doing the trick in terms of, I mean, if you talk to Gordian Fuldy, for example, at St Vincent's, he'll tell you they've been fantastic for stopping that sort of stuff. It's a controversial thing. What do you think of that for down here in Victoria?
Well, it is controversial, and I'm not sure that their statistics show that they're doing any better than us. And as you'll see in the commentary in the paper, there's a lot of people would think it's not such a bad thing to be able to go to a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning and have a good time. So, I mean, you don't want to unnecessarily restrict people's liberty. You know, what you want to do, and this is why the research is important, because you only want to restrict individual liberties if they're definitely shown to make a difference.
Yeah.
And so this is a particular example. I think there are things you can do around restricting access to alcohol and street violence by just some very straightforward corralling of people in certain areas, and so you don't have to be draconian. You can just have some common sense rules around it.
So the jury's still out on lockout.
Definitely.
Is there anything else from the paper that either of you want to highlight or bring up?
Well, I think the main thing is the message of hope. Because, I mean, I think as a, you know, in the area of injury, we tend to get a bit bogged down and say, you know, every year there's still hundreds of people dying and despite all these interventions. But actually, compared with virtually any other intervention we do in medicine, the interventions have had an incredible impact.
Yeah.
And this didn't measure the morbidity side of it. And if you look at the improvements in that over time as well,
yeah.
You're talking, you know, like the impact on society is huge. So I think it's a sort of reassurance we're on the right track and we should redouble our efforts to prevent, you know, to intervene.
Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.